Hey, hello everyone, and welcome to episode 3 of Beyond Nitro. It's Guy Evans here again with you exclusively on adfreeshows.com. And for this month's episode, I'm actually joined by a longtime member of the Ad Free Shows community. I think he's been there since the very beginning, as a matter of fact, and that is none other than TJ Stevens. TJ, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Guy. Yes, I have been here since the beginning. Ironically enough, AFS started on what was my 35th birthday.
Is that right?
That is right. So not only is it nice at this point to be one of the longest tenured guys, but it's also, you know, it's coming up on my 4-year anniversary. So, and my 39th birthday. All things easy to remember, all one day. I love it.
Well, congratulations on both of those upcoming anniversary, shall we say.
Thank you.
But it's great to have you aboard here, TJ. And I want to just talk briefly here and inform the listeners about what we're doing today. So you might remember at the conclusion, really, of last month's episode, I was talking about different ways that possibly we could include the Ad-Free Shows community with the show. And I was actually really pleased to get on a Zoom call with a bunch of the top guys last week on Wednesday, and got some great feedback and suggestions for the show. But, you know, one of the things I think about this show that people have appreciated so far, and I think will continue to appreciate as we move forward, is just having some variety. You know, we don't want to necessarily do the same thing month after month. You know, I think some months I might come on here and it might just be a solo. Other times we might have a guest. But for episode 3 here, what we've decided to do is have TJ come on kind of as a representative, really, of the Ad-Free Shows community. I think we're going to have a really interesting discussion. I think we're going to help everyone get to know a little bit more about the book which inspired this series in the first place, and, you know, any other topics really that the TJ would like to get into. But before we go any further, TJ, you know, I want to give you the floor here just to tell people a little bit more about yourself. Obviously you've been there since the beginning as a member. You're coming up on 4 years now, but I understand that you have a bit of a background in this kind of radio / podcast world as well, right?
Yeah, so I originally started podcasting way back in 2014. My cousin David and I had a wrestling podcast. It was called The Squared Circle, but circle was spelled with an S because both of our last names and or start with S because we're original people. And I was actually, during that time, I was going to college on a communications major to become a journalist. And in that time, I landed a gig at my local radio station here. I was on 8 to 11 p.m. weeknights. That was recorded. And then I had a Saturday morning show, 8 to 11 in the morning live. So I was on six days a week. And then, and then during NASCAR season, my producer actually asked me one day if I'd be willing to come in on Sundays and do a NASCAR pre-show. And I told him, I said, Dennis, if I came on for a seventh straight day, I think they would chase me out of here with torches. Like, I'm not doing 7 days. I did that for 2.5 years.
That's a little
years.
Too much.
Yeah, it's a little bit. It's oversaturation is what we call that in media. So did that for 2.5 years. I left, not because I didn't love it. I did. My son was born around that time. And I had a full-time job at a factory. So I just went and did that. Started podcasting again, actually, in 2020 after I became a member of AFS. And then a group of top guys did a show called Top Guy Theater, led by me. That went on for over a year. And ever since, I've been the co-host of Filter Free Podcast, a podcast with two guys that are also, one is a current Top Guy, one's a former. And we cover wrestling, but we also cover pop culture, music, movies, sports from, say, a show in wrestling 25 years ago, but this month, like it's an anniversary show, and we'll just immerse you in that time. So I've always loved wrestling, been a fan since I was 4. As you can tell, I love to talk, and I'm more than excited to do this show today.
Well, that's fantastic. So the name of the podcast, once again, is the Filter Free Podcast. Is that right?
Filter Free Popcast.
Popcast. Okay,
yeah, great. I said podcast, and I'm going to get yelled at for that, but it's podcast.
Oh, I'm sure it was probably my bad hearing. Don't worry about it. So people can go and check that out. And, TJ, I don't think that you would mind me saying that, really the impetus for today's episode was, you being kind and thoughtful enough to reach out to me after episode one, just with some ideas in terms of where we could take the show and perhaps how you could be part of the mix. So I want to thank you for that, first of all, in making that happen. And, at this point, I think I want to turn the floor over to you because I'm really curious to find out what it is that you would like to talk about. And I think we'll be able to have a great discussion today about some of those areas. So take it away.
Yeah, so once the Nitro book came out, and of course I bought it immediately because WCW, both as a wrestling entity, but then if you include the behind the scenes business part of it, and I just don't mean WCW solely. I also including Time Warner, and of course the merger later on. I am far more fascinated by that aspect of it than anything on camera we saw in WCW. And that's not to say WCW did not have interesting times. They certainly did. But again, the business side is just crazy to me. But there's so much to discuss here. So my first thought when I read Nitro is this is not a small book. There's a lot of information. And the sheer just volume that you gave us, my first thought was the research. So my first question, I believe you referenced it in the book, but I just want to clarify for people who maybe haven't read it yet.
Yes.
How many interview subjects did you have for this book?
That's a really good question. I think I lost count after about 120, which is why on the back of the book, I think it says over 120. Those interviews took many different forms. Some were over the phone, some were in person. There were other people with whom I developed relationships that carried on for a number of years. And, we would meet up and then have a follow-up conversation over the phone. We'd text, we'd email. But in terms of individual people who were interviewed for the book, it's somewhere north of 120. And that wasn't necessarily the plan from the beginning, but that's certainly what things evolved into very quickly.
So this is, I mean, I don't know if I've ever heard of a book that had over 120 interviewed subjects. That is bananas to me. So with this just mammoth list of subjects that you track down, now this list includes WCW talent, WCW management, as well as Turner management and AOL management. Do I have that right?
That's correct, yeah.
So let's start with this. How did you go about creating this list of interview subjects, and how far into the management tree of WCW Turner AOL did you want to go when you first envisioned this book?
Another great question. I mean, I think thinking back originally, my idea was I wanted to have representation from as many divisions within WCW as a company as possible. So I think originally I was thinking, let me talk to someone from production, let me talk to someone from marketing, let me talk to someone from someone on the talent side of things, so on and so forth, so that I can say I've covered all my bases by at least having a representative from each of those areas. But what became quite clear early on is actually some of the best content and stories and anecdotes and information that you would receive would be from people you wouldn't necessarily have predicted. So, you would think that you would get the best stuff from some of the big names that we're all familiar with, but that isn't necessarily always the case. A lot of times it's people who, may not have worked in wrestling prior to the WCW era, may not have worked in wrestling following the WCW era, and therefore remember those times in painstaking detail. Sometimes you might talk to someone who was a production assistant who maybe spent 3 months in the wacky world of wrestling and then went off to do a bunch of other things. And therefore, if you ask them about their time in that world, they're going to remember more or less every single detail. So it's something that really grew over time. And I think what I was really motivated to do was to, you know, approach this in such a way where I was being the opposite of intellectually dishonest, I suppose, if intellectually honest is a phrase, right? I didn't want to, you know, tick the box of, yeah, I spoke to a few people, but, you know, that's enough now. I can package this all together and release a book on WCW. I wanted it to be definitive to where, you know, essentially anyone who had a major say in the story could say that at the very least they were asked to be interviewed. You know, not envisioning it was necessarily going to be in excess of 120 people. So I think it was just really motivated by a desire to do the right thing and to tell the story correctly for the people whose lives were affected. And, you know, not to ramble on here, I will just say, you know, one final thing on this subject. Oftentimes we forget as people who were fans back then that, you know, over 150 people lost their jobs the day that WCW right. closed down.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know for a fact that over the years, there had been sort of a yearning on the part of many of those people for someone to come along and find out essentially what happened to WCW. And I think, you know, fortunately, the book was able to answer some of those questions, especially as it related to how the shows actually got canceled, why the Fusion deal at the end fell through, how the WWF at the time was able to purchase their competition for, you know, just over $4 million. You know, the book was able to answer a lot of those questions. And I think it put a lot of those people's minds to ease that after so many years, something had come along, which it kind of gave them a bit of closure, I think.
Yeah, I will say when I got to the end of this book, and I'm a giant wrestling nerd. Like, I've read all the books. I've watched the documentaries. I've read the articles. Mm-hmm. When I found out, and I don't want to say just now because I don't want to spoil it, but when mm-hmm. I found out exactly what all went down at the mm-hmm. finality of WCW, I nearly dropped the book. I was just stunned how that all broke down.
Oh yeah, it's a wild story for sure, and there's a lot of twists and turns that I think prior to the book coming out, you know, were not known, and were certainly not widely known, and that there's definitely some revelations in the last couple of chapters, I think. But I think by speaking to so many people and sort of going through the research process, what I think the book did hopefully is give more of a well-rounded interpretation as to what the incentives were that were acting on the various decision makers at that particular time, because it's tempting to kind of devolve into caricatures of people and say, well, you know, I'm just going to reduce this person to a one sentence summary of what I think happened or what I think their attitude towards WCW or wrestling was. And that's not a defense of anyone in particular, by the way, but you know, you think about someone like Jamie Kellner. Obviously, you know, I was not happy with the fact that WCW was canceled from the Turner Networks. I wish it never happened. So, you know, by no means is what I'm saying any kind of defense of him or anyone else. But I do think it's important to look at from the perspective of sometimes people who are not fans of wrestling and don't understand the genre as a whole, what were the incentives that were acting upon them at the time? What choices did they have at their disposal? What options were placed on their desk? It kind of gives you a more holistic sense of why they made the decisions that they did, as opposed to, again, sometimes the caricature, which is, yeah, this guy just came into a room one day and said, you know, cancel that wrestling fake bullshit because right. I don't like it. You know, this guy was CEO of Turner Broadcasting in a post-merger environment. You know, I'm not so sure that it would have been as simple as that. And of course, the book provides some more detail to that end. So again, you know, not a defense whatsoever of those kind of decisions. But I just think, you know, if you're interested in the real story and the true story, you do have to step back and try to look at it from that standpoint, I think.
And when you're going into this depth, and we've discussed the research methods through interviews anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's only part of the battle. We also need documentation
mm-hmm.
that we can either back up or refute testimony with. And when I read a book like this, so many hands in the pot here,
mm-hmm.
So many different stories that want to be told because not everyone in Turner was a giant fan of WCW. So as you're gathering the concrete documentation,
Yes.
was there information that you found that actually refuted some testimony that you had gotten from an interview?
Oh, absolutely, all the time. And that's why there were a number of people that I spoke to whose words and names never made it into the book, because they would make claims that subsequently I would find things that didn't align with that. And so that's part of the process as well. Obviously, taking a step back, anyone who's producing any sort of creative work has to acknowledge that none of us are without our biases, none of us are without our weaknesses. None of us can do a perfect job at anything, but what you try to do is try to get it as close to that as possible. And so, in order to do that, you have to be prepared sometimes to sift through some information and some perspectives that may not be in alignment with the truth. So, sure, I can remember a few times where people would talk about, for example, the financial performance of WCW. And I was fortunate enough to have access to some of the financial statements. So, I was able to sort of listen to them on the phone and, quietly open my drawer and pull out those statements and say, is this person misremembering? Are they completely inventing something? Are they trying to misrepresent something? Or have they actually got access to the same information that I have? So, that's when you speak to that many people, often about the same subject, that's a challenge in and of itself to try to cross-reference what they're telling you with what you have in front of you. Again, keeping in mind that not everyone has the same information, and also people's memories do strange things over the years. And if you don't believe that, try meeting up with some old friends or some old relatives and talk about things that may have happened back in the day, and you'll be amazed at, to what extent sometimes your recollections will vary. So that's another thing, that people, when I say people, all of us, we don't always keep in mind when we're watching a documentary or reading a book about something that happened during a particular historical period. Just because you're talking to the principal people who are involved in that story doesn't mean that what they're saying is necessarily gospel, even if they're trying to be truthful. Like I said, sometimes the memory can do funny things. And so there is a certain qualitative aspect of trying to make a judgment about the veracity of what people are saying as well. And so it's a, as you might imagine, your head starts spinning after a while trying to make sense of all of that.
All right, so I got my pen and my paper here. I'm going to start a list. WCW liars. You want to go ahead and start naming some names? Let's go ahead and get them on Twitter.
Sure, let's go.
I'm kidding. So, again, I'm just so fascinated by the sheer amount of interviews. This is easily the most interesting part of the research gathering part of this book, because again, the sheer amount. How did you find these people? Because I doubt they're all on LinkedIn. And not everyone, again, as we mentioned, in the Turner AOL umbrella is the biggest fan of WCW. I'm sure they weren't just head over heels like, oh, please, let's bring that up again. So how did you track these people down and get them to open up to you?
So I think you'll really appreciate this, TJ. I feel like based on your age and the little bit that I know about you, I have a sense that you might appreciate what I'm about to say, which is, we live in an almost fully digital world now, right? And there's the idea that everything can be found through a Google search. And I can tell you that, if you're embarking on something like this and you're trying to do something creative or something of this scope, 99.9% of the information that you're going to find is actually going to be in the analog world. And so what I mean by that is, real information is in people's heads, and you can't access that through a Google search. The same can also be said for, particular people. I mean, again, it might seem sort of unfathomable in a way, but there are a whole generation of people that never really migrated to the same extent that future generations did to a lot of social media sites, LinkedIn, as you said. There are people out there that aren't big email, users. There are people out there who don't mess around with the internet too much. Those people are still out there. And so sometimes actually the most interesting and impactful people that I was introduced to, actually some of those situations would happen in person. I'm not denigrating the idea of conducting research via computer and using the internet and all that kind of stuff, but a lot of times when you reach out to people, especially if they have talked about a subject many times before, they're going to have certain stock answers. And so just because you get them on the phone for 20 or 30 minutes, there's no guarantee that anything is really going to come of that. And it's sometimes it's only through building those relationships and actually getting to meet them and getting to know them that you not only, you know, help the whatever it is that you're working on, but actually develop some new relationships as well, which is a really nice part of the process also. But yeah, there's still people out there that, you know, are not particularly accessible. There's no sort of master list or database that you can just go on and, you know, with a click of a button, email 120 or 200 or 300 people at one time. But, you know, I will also say this as well, TJ, and I think, again, you'll appreciate this. It's one thing, I think, sometimes to try to garner all of those perspectives from different people, but it's another thing to sort of make sense of it as well. So theoretically, you could do a book where you speak to 20,000 people, right? Mm-hmm. But that's not necessarily a guarantee that the final product is going to be coherent. So, you know, I think really what I tried to do is, again, speak to as many people as I could. I didn't want anyone to say that they weren't at least approached to be involved. But then, you know, ultimately the real challenge is putting all of that together. But, you know, some of the relationships, like I said, that have come out of this have just been just wonderful. And that's definitely the best part of doing it, I would have to say.
Let me answer everyone's question right now. Did you interview Judy Bagwell?
Not that I recall. I did speak to her son, Buff. Judy may have been in the background now that I think about it. and her name did come up. He brought her up fairly quickly. But no, I don't think I did an in-depth interview with her.
Would have loved her perspective on the Judy Bagwell in a pole match.
That may have changed everything. Mm. Now I'm sitting here in a state of regret.
So let's talk about one more research item before we kind of scratch the surface on the man of the reason why this book ever even took place. So I think my overall arching question for the research aspect, whether it be documentation or interview topics, you interviewed several WCW wrestlers. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean this to sound negative, mm-hmm. but wrestlers tend to be exaggerators. So as they're telling you their stories about, you know, I think the most famous instance of an exaggerated WCW story is Eric Bischoff throwing coffee on Eddie Guerrero, which we now know didn't happen. So as you're hearing these stories, even as entertaining as they may be, how do you go back and sort of pare it down to, okay, this is what really happened, but maybe this story is better the way that it is. I have to clarify that it's not entirely true, but this story is better as opposed to, well, I'll just use documentation in this instance because I can't really use this story.
Sure. So I think if someone is quoted and they're giving their perspective and they're giving their recollection of a particular event, then that has to be taken for what it is, which is their recollection of that particular event. Now, if there's some sort of objective documentation that you can point to disprove that, then that obviously changes things somewhat. And also if you get the sense that someone is just wholesale inventing something out of thin air, I can remember one instance where, you know, you mentioned the wrestler component, where one of the wrestlers I spoke to was talking about him being asked to lose to David Flair, right? And so as he's saying this, I'm looking it up and, yep, this definitely happened. This is ringing some bells, and I can see here, yep, it did happen around the time frame that he's describing. Okay, let me listen to the rest of his story. So the wrinkle or the tweaks that he sort of added to his own story was that It was the main event match at the Georgia Dome, and I believe the figure that they used was in front of 80,000 people. So obviously, WCW never drew that many people at the Georgia Dome, right? This particular match, right? Exactly. Unless you want to go into the North Korea, events, but people were forced to be there, right? But the match that, you know, he was talking about, I mean, it did happen, right? Like, you can look it up. The match did happen, but it wasn't in Atlanta. It wasn't at the Georgia Dome. There was definitely not 80,000 people there. It wasn't a main event. But, you know, conceivably, you could have run with that and said, yeah, you know, this is what this guy remembers. But that that's an example of where there's obviously the ability to present a counterfactual and disprove that. So, you know, it's a balancing act like anything else. You have to sort of weigh up these things and use your own judgment at times, and no one can get it perfect. But I think as long as you're making a good faith effort, people respect and understand that in general, I think.
Yeah, I kind of want to look that up now, but because it was probably like Murfreesboro, Tennessee or something like that. But I think we've done enough research talk.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get to why we're here. So I'm excited, again, that you're giving me this opportunity, and I'm excited to talk about this because even though I'm from Northern Indiana, I'm an hour outside of Chicago, I've been a WWF kid since late 89. My first favorite wrestler was Mr. Perfect. Like, I was never a Hogan guy. But I was also, during the Monday Night Wars, I was the kid either changing the channel back and forth or recording Nitro. Later on, I started recording Nitro. And here in Chapter 1, which we're going to scratch the surface on a little bit here on this show, you entitled it called The Offer. That was the name you gave the chapter. And we get a glimpse of the man who becomes really the, even though he's not always the main topic of the book, he's the interweaving mesh of the story. And he's a fierce entrepreneur by any record given by anyone ever, but he's a fan of wrestling. But in all intents and purposes, here in 1988, he is the savior of WCW, bought from, you know, almost going underwater with Jim Crockett Promotions. And it seems like at times, going through the testimony of this book, the only guy that believed in WCW. So let's just start from the beginning here, chapter one with Ted. During your research, from what you gathered and testimony you acquired, what was your first impression of the man, Ted Turner?
Well, there's this word that is often overused, I think, as it relates to someone like Ted, but I'm going to use it anyway, which is the word maverick. Mm-hmm. And that might be a little bit cliche to say, but Ted Turner truly was a maverick. And I think, as the book mentions at some point, it may even be in chapter one, I sort of regard his story as a quintessential American story, because sure, he did inherit, you know, his father's billboard advertising business. It wasn't like he started completely at zero, let's say. But the way that he expounded upon that and went into so many different areas and did so in a way that really demonstrated just complete self-belief and trust in his instincts. You know, you hear this, another word which is thrown around a lot nowadays, you know, the word visionary. Mm-hmm. You hear that applied a lot to seemingly anyone who's in a position of leadership. You know, Ted, for better or worse, was that visionary. I mean, there's a story somewhere in the book about him pitching to a group of executives the idea of CNN before it existed, and basically people looking around the room like, this guy's lost his mind. Who's ever thought of a 24-hour a day news station? You know, who the hell is going to be watching that? Well, you know, for better or for worse, he saw where things were going in that particular industry and had that vision before anyone else. And there's so many examples of that. And that's not always to say that he got everything right. That's not always to say that his public comments, which if you look up now, you'll see, you know, a lot of them were sort of off the wall and pretty zany. And he was very much unpredictable and said some things at times that, you know, an advisor probably wouldn't have scripted him to say. But I regard Ted as actually quite a refreshing character, because you look at the corporate CEOs and various people in positions of leadership across society that we have today, and I don't want to use the expression cookie cutter necessarily, but in many cases, you can almost predict exactly what they're going to say before they say it. You know what the buzzwords are going to be. You know what the tone of their message is going to be.
Well, we're in the PR era, so I mean, it all sounds the same now.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. And they're not going to necessarily say anything that's going to cause you to stop and think. But with Ted, you never knew what he was going to say. And so, I just really appreciate that. I really appreciate his story just from a personal standpoint, the way that, again, yes, he did have somewhere to start from, but boy, did he turn that into something, and also overcame a lot of obstacles in his own life. His father, committing suicide and things of that nature that the book goes into. He certainly didn't have an easy go of it. And in a second, I want to throw it back to you here, TJ, but there's one anecdote which is shared in the book, which I find to be so insightful about his personality and really encapsulates everything he was about. But I want to ask you, what is your perspective on Ted? What is your perception of him, both, I suppose, prior and after reading the book? What do you make of him?
When it comes to Ted, you hear the word maverick a lot, and and again, we bandy that word about a lot now, but it with him it fits, because it almost seemed like his stubbornness, and sometimes it didn't seem like his willingness to go against the grain. It was his want to go against the grain. And again, with CNN, prime example. Like again, it's 1978, I believe, 79, somewhere in there. He starts CNN. It gets laughed out of the room, and here we are, 45 years later. It's still around. Like it's still, one of the more widely watched 24-hour news shows or news channels around. But I feel Ted doesn't get the credit he deserves enough for how well he understood television. Especially from the beginning.
Well, just to sort of piggyback on your comment there and provide a little bit more color to the TED discussion.
Okay, yes.
There's a story somewhere in the book which I really think encapsulates everything that TED was about, and it's, like I said, it's very insightful. It comes from Bill Burk, who was previously the head of TBS, and actually he was put in charge of that network at a very young age. I think he was about 26 or something like that.
Well,
So that's kind of interesting to think about when you're reading the book and you hear him talking about, we were doing this and that at the network. The guy was 26 years old. So somewhat of a whiz kid. He actually went on to write one of Ted's autobiographies as well, or
nice.
co-write it with him.
Wow.
But Bill talks about a story where Ted was sat opposite an advertiser. I think it was American Express, and they were kind of talking about, Ted, we don't know about committing to advertising on your networks. I mean, you've got, like you said there, TJ, Andy Griffith show, and there's this wrestling stuff. Like, what's that all about? And finally, Ted pulls out his Amex card from his wallet and says, I use your guys' product, but you don't want to be associated with mine, and I've got a problem with that. And I think that speaks so much to the guy's character and how he viewed his audience. He didn't look at them as people to look down upon, or country bumpkins, or people to be taken for granted. He recognized there was value in that audience and what they watched, and there was value in the programming as well. And the point of contention, I suppose, which has always existed over the years, really relates to what was Ted's personal relationship with professional wrestling. So you'll read some accounts that will say, yeah, the guy was a huge wrestling fan. There'll be other people who will say, yeah, not so much, but he kind of liked the idea of keeping that tradition alive and keeping it on the air. other people will point to the fact that for the longest time it was very inexpensive programming, and so it was more of a financial motive for TED.
That's the one I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. I think there's merit to all of those in different to different degrees, right?
Sure. Yeah.
The aspect which I think sometimes may get left on the table is the fact that, similar to the story which I just described, there was a part of Ted's personality that liked the fact that there's something on our networks which is doing extremely well in terms of ratings that makes people feel uncomfortable. So he almost liked the idea that our executives have to go to a TNT or a TBS function. They have to go to an award ceremony. They have to go to a conference. And when they're having a cocktail or when they're having a gathering with their peers and someone asks, you know, hey, what's your guys' highest rated programming right now? That they have to say World Championship Wrestling. He actually liked the idea that people that would consider themselves highbrow would be put in a position where they'd have to talk about it. And so that was definitely an element to his personality. He liked to stir the shit. He liked a bit of controversy. He liked to make people feel uncomfortable. And I think he found it, I won't say amusing, but I think he found it a bit charming that, you know, hey, I've got this form of programming on the air that all of you guys, you know, turn your noses up at. And actually, it's the reason why we're doing, you know, the numbers that we're doing in no small part. And so I always smile when I think about that and keep that in mind, because again, how many people in Ted's position would sort of take that approach today? And that's the reason why a lot of the WCW wrestlers truly believed that as long as Ted was in power, WCW would always have a home at Turner, regardless of how much money they may have been losing, because he always wanted to keep the wrestling around. I guess in closing, TJ, I just want to throw things back to you and ask you if there's anything else that you wanted to raise or any other comments you wanted to make, you know, based on our discussion here today, because for sure I've really enjoyed it. So thank you.
Well, and thank you for having me. But I first, you know, of course, I listened to the first two episodes of this show, and of course, it's always, you know, I'm never not in for a WCW, you know, Tales from Back When listening session. I'm all day, every day. But again, for me, it's something we don't normally hear about is the process of writing, you know, a book of this magnitude, a nonfiction book. And I think what gets lost in that too is people think, oh, it's a nonfiction book, you're just regurgitating information. Well, no, you need a voice to do it. You need you need an overarching story. Even though it's nonfiction, you still need a story to weave the readers through it, because no one's going to read a statistical analysis of WCW and the merger. Like no one's going to do that. So I wanted to talk about that. And also, there was, as we read through the book, there's so many things that just
so many layers.
Yeah, just graze it on the way by, and you're reading like, well, what happened there? But you're of course you're not going to tell that story in the book because it doesn't fit. But maybe in this context, we can elaborate on some of those things and discuss. So that's kind of what I was hoping to achieve here on this show. I hope I did, and I had a great time. Thank you for letting me do this.
Oh no, it was a blast, TJ, and you know, I really look forward to hearing the feedback and reading what you guys think about this episode. Again, as we talked about in the intro, definitely a fan of switching things up, and we've definitely got some interesting programming planned, I think, over the next few months. But if possible, TJ, I'd love to do this again, and
yes,
you know, we can pick things up with chapter one, get into some other areas of the book. I definitely want to give you the floor to speak, because you have a lot to offer, I think, as well, and a lot of opinions and insight that people would find interesting. Before we wrap up here, just one more time, where can people go if they want to listen to what you're doing, follow you on social media? Can you give them all those links?
Well, on Twitter and on Instagram, I am at tstephens91. That's STEPHENS. And then my the podcast I do, we're getting ready to, in May, we'll be hitting our 3-year anniversary. and it's called the Filter Free Popcast. You can follow us on Twitter at FF Popcast, on Instagram at Filter Free Popcast, and we drop every Tuesday morning. So we're a great way to start your week. And that's pretty much all I got going.
Beautiful. Well, thank you again, TJ. I really appreciate the time. And for everyone listening, we'll see you next time. Beyond Nitro.